decade of dissident discourse. It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial X. This is the ninth night, and there are going to be five streams tonight, four interviews. In 2 hours, it'll be Dan Tubb, and then 3 hours after that, it'll be Walt Bismarck, and then Harrison H. Smith. And then I'll be doing the Winter Solstice AMA. But first, it is, a hotly anticipated guest each year, Godfrey Bloom. This is the fourth time he's appearing on Millennial. So, Godfrey, thank you for agreeing to appear again.
Well, thank you very much indeed for inviting me, and a very happy Christmas to all your viewers.
Well, thank you. So I think we should start by, I don't think we need any introduction. I think people know who you are, so that's fine. So I'll just go straight into it and ask, what kind of year do you think 2024 has been in general?
Gosh, dear, oh dear, that nearly bowled me out middle stump first ball. it's been pretty bloody awful, hasn't it, really, I suppose, all around. We got rid of a right numpty government to get an even bigger numpty government in. I would now argue, perhaps, we're politically, almost 90% of the population is politically homeless. Not that many people voted last time. Starmer got in, but he didn't get in with a creased vote, of course, did he? He got in, he had the same vote, broadly speaking, as last time. People just didn't bother to vote for the Conservative Party because the Conservative Party doesn't exist anymore. Left-wing, it's a sort of neo-socialist party, and we've now got a fully rabid socialist party in. So not a good year, generally speaking, for the country. Good year for me, because I'm still alive, and I'm 75 years old, and I passed my birthday in November, and I'm still fully fit and climbing fells and walking the dog and so on and so forth. I nearly got in a punch up in a car park the other day, so I'm fighting fit.
Fantastic. Congratulations. Yeah, I'm sorry to... I didn't warn you that I would ask about the year. It didn't occur to me until we actually started. But again, that does have a... there are a few issues there. And this is to do with Britain. Indeed, for the first, 6 months, 7 months of this year, we were still under the Conservative government with Rishi Sunak. It seemed to me that the Conservative government was sort of, it seemed like it was committing suicide by having him. He was ineffectual. What would you say about that, the state of the Conservative Party? Of course, now they've got Kemi Badenoch. So let's talk about the state of the Conservative Party just now.
Well, I had a long train journey back from Brussels 10 years or so ago with Lord Hannan. And we were discussing then the demise of the Conservative Party and the standard of MP. And he said it's the sort of people now that are being attracted into the Conservative Party are journeyman professional politicians who haven't got any original thoughts. They just want to be an MP. And of course, the problem we had with the subsequent prime ministers was the Conservative prime ministers only wanted to be prime minister. Now, if I were prime minister, and I'd like to be prime minister, it would be because I could change so much, or I would try and change so much. All sorts of terrible things in the country, like overregulation, the highest tax since before I was born. All these things where it's going wrong, regulation, high taxation, all the wrong things to run an economy. And of course, what people are really interested in is the economy, their families, how much money have they got in their pocket, what's the future for themselves and their children and their loved ones and the elderly and the pensioners, so on and so forth. And can we steer clear of wars? Wars are, generally speaking, a very bad thing. I'm afraid the Conservative Party, at the end of it, didn't tick a single box. We got a fake Brexit, which everybody had a referendum in 2016. We voted for Brexit. We didn't get it because May spiked it. Theresa May spiked it. And one asked oneself, and I'm sure your viewers will ask the same thing, how do these people get there? One asked myself, how did Theresa May get to be prime minister? You know, how did Cameron get to be prime minister? He's actually, for all his polished accents and all the rest of it, he's thick as a plank. And so consequently, as anything, when he saw that American interview about Magna Carta with Cameron, he didn't have a clue. And it's a sort of fundamental principle of our constitution and our unwritten constitution. So, and then we had, Boris Johnson. There was a peace deal signed in Turkey in April 2002, a peace deal. The signatures, the initials were all on it to stop the war in Ukraine. He flew out immediately and he stopped it. And since that time, I think there's an estimate of 250,000 Ukrainians have died. Lord only knows how many have been maimed. And now, of course, the war is grinding to a halt. It was an unnecessary war, totally sponsored by the neocons in Washington. And of course, the Conservative Party run along like a good little doggy doing exactly what the Americans want. This lot are no exception. They're all World Economic Forum stooges, ex-Goldman Sachs. They're stooges of big business, Farnborough, and all the rest of it, and BlackRock. Never have I known, and I'm an old geezer, our political system and our legal system, sadly, to be so corrupt. We are really Nigeria or some third world country with a little bit of polish on it. It isn't, taking money under the clock at Waterloo in a brown envelope, but that's what we're doing. And Lord only knows how much Boris Johnson got from the industrial military complex for keeping the war going, because make no mistake, we all know that this is about money. And it's been about money and resources and regime change of the Russian Federation since the very beginning. So we are dealing with the West now is totally and utterly corrupt. And it's dragging the whole of Western Europe down. The Germans are going into recession, economic recession. The Americans have never seen so much large debt. And for all their £1 trillion a year, it now appears that NATO kit, NATO weaponry, and NATO organization is getting duffed up a treat by the Russian Federation. Disasters all around and all so avoidable.
Absolutely. And I think the main thing I want to focus on here is the Conservative Party and how corrupt, useless, incompetent in some ways, but mostly corrupt it is now. And I think the main thing that it seems to me, I'd like to ask what you think of this, the main thing it seems to me about the Conservative Party is that they just don't believe in anything at all. They have no principles whatsoever anymore. Would you say that's true?
Yes, I would. And that's what I was really driving at when I said, you know, that Cameron and Theresa May, and I would argue since... wasn't that funny, forgettable little fellow who ran away from the circus to be a banker, work for a bank. What's that? I keep forgetting his bloody name. He followed Margaret Thatcher anyway.
John Major.
John Major. God, how forgettable is that? The grey little man with no original ideas in his head. And it's been ever thus. That there was no... Now, Maggie Thatcher made mistakes. I'm not suggesting she didn't make some mistakes. But she was as close to a conviction politician as you can get under our system. And there is no conviction in the others at all. The subsequent prime ministers had no form of conviction. They stood four square for nothing in particular. And all they really wanted to do is hang on to office. And when things were getting so bad, they called a spot election, which they knew they were going to lose. It's impossible that they didn't know they were going to lose, and they didn't even bother to fight much of a campaign. And of course, they were swept out of office by apathy. All the traditional Conservative Party voters just didn't turn out. They didn't vote Labour. They didn't vote for anybody else. And Nigel Farage, I have to say, got it right when he said the rural Conservative, never underestimate the stupidity of the rural Conservative. And even, and I live in the East Riding of Yorkshire, I live in a very rural community which has voted Conservative for decades and decades and decades. hundreds of years. So I live in that kind of community, and even they didn't vote Conservative. Even they didn't vote Conservative. So nobody voted Conservative. It was only Conservative MPs with majorities of in the region of 15,000 who retained their seats. And so the baby went out with the bathwater, and but it serves them right. I mean, they were unelectable. Yeah. So, of course, Starmer walked in. Of course, we heard from Diane Abbott. How bad can Starmer be if Godfrey Bloom is agreeing with Diane Abbott? How bad can things be when we've got to that? And she said, she was quite right. She said he was parachuted in from nowhere. He had no experience whatsoever of politics. He's politically inept. Everything he touches seems to go rotten. And he's surrounded people, actually, who should be on a Tesco checkout counter, most of them. I mean, all that lot. I'm absolutely hopeless. They're hopeless. In fact, they wouldn't get a job on a Tesco checkout because they can't do numbers. So we have this next lot that's come in, who then you might argue we think are just stupid and thick. But Starmer was very clear when he was asked by Emily No Mates in that interview whether or not he thought Parliament was the most important or Davos. And he was quite clear. He said Davos, which showed some, if not honesty, political ineptitude. So
he said it with no hesitation as well.
There was no hesitation at all. He didn't sit on the balance Davos. Or we need both. He was quite clear about it. And of course, now what he's doing, he's actually bringing some fascinating policies. One is a Stalinist policy. He wants to get rid of small farmers. And this is the inheritance tax procedure, so that they will all have to sell up because they are asset rich, but cash poor. The children can't pay that tax, and of course it falls on the children who would have taken over the farm. They will end up managing those farms. The farms will amalgamate and come under BlackRock or whomsoever, or JP Morgan will own, or the big international players will own farmland. Bill Gates, perish the thought. And all these things will come about, and they will be pushed off the land. We saw this in the 1930s Soviet Union, if you remember your history. And so we know, and there were millions of them pushed off the land. And so this is something he's doing. He's increasing the public sector, which is now something like 750,000 more than it was 10 years ago. The Conservatives were no better. And some of the jobs, if people want to Google them up, some of the most recent jobs are absolutely fascinating, and they're really non-jobs. They are totally and utterly non-jobs. And of course, they come with big salaries and index-linked pensions. And what people didn't pick up, and the mainstream media didn't pick up, because it's in the government's pocket, whichever government of the day it is, when he gave everybody a 5% increase, broadly speaking, in the public sector, he gave everybody a pension scheme when they can retire at 63, most of them, index-linked. The cost of this to the exchequer is running in the region of, I would guess, and I used to be in the business of pension fund management, I would think now that the overhang of that is probably £1 trillion. It's probably £1 trillion a year. And I live in a rural village, very small village, only 120 souls. But there are at least, I think, 10 households, who have retired from the public sector, with money coming out of their ears. But of course, it's taxpayers' money. It's not funded. These people don't have a funded. It comes straight from the taxpayer. And they're the ones with the new cars and expensive holidays, so on and so forth. They're all sucking at the tit. And moreover, they don't even realize that the pathetic amount they contributed to their pension schemes bears no relation to what they're actually getting. They get a bit upset. They go, well, I put into my pension, you know, for my 30 or 40 years, whatever. I'll say, how much did you put in? You know, what was it, £5, £10 a week or something like that? And yeah, that's what it was. Then now, and if you work it out, and I actually worked, because I'm a geek when it comes to this kind of thing, when it comes to actuarial statistics, I added up that just in my small village alone, the cost of the pensions that people are getting now is round about £17 million in my tiny village alone. Multiply that across the country. Retired teachers, council workers, civil servants, quangos, all on the same ticket, don't forget. So on and so forth. We can't afford it. We're going broke rapidly. And quite what's going to happen in the future, I really don't know. Because none of this can be afforded. the only money for the public sector available is that which is created by the wealth-creating sector, the private sector, which is shrinking under the weight of regulation and taxation, so on and so forth. Quite where we're going to go in 2025, I really don't know. I suspect we're going down the lavatory like the rest of Western Europe.
Indeed. Well, you went through a huge range of topics there, but I did want to pick up on the Labour Party. Everything you've said there is interesting, but I want to concentrate on the Labour Party because it seems to me that so the Conservatives were unelectable. Everyone also hated the Labour, but by default, they got in. So, and as you say, Keir Starmer had been parachuted in. He has, and this is something that's really come to the fore since they got elected, is that he has no charisma whatsoever and no, what would be the word, sense of what to, how to endear himself to the public, what to say and what not to say. Like that remark about Davos, he should have just lied and said, well, of course I care about Westminster more, but he didn't have the sense to do that. But then on top of that, he doesn't seem to care. He doesn't seem to care whether he's liked or not. It's just he's there to do a job. Whether the people like him or appreciate him or despise him doesn't seem to matter. And I think that's quite unusual for a politician, especially.
On my channel, I did an interview with Professor, I've gone blank again, Professor Cummings, I think. Anyway, it's on my website. Who's an expert in the field, is professor of these matters of the mind, of the psyche, of the personality. And he picked up on some facts and he drilled down. Apparently, he's what is called a parentalist. His mother, very sadly, was suffering from very severe rheumatoid arthritis when he was 10 or 11. And he had to become, as it were, the man of the house. He had to look after his mother. He didn't have any friends. He couldn't go out to play. He had to look after mother. And of course, that scarred him. So he doesn't have any empathy for his fellow man or woman, because his childhood, I'm not a trick cyclist, but apparently this is a well-known phenomenon with these people, which means they're not quite right, which he doesn't understand. He doesn't understand why he's unpopular. He generally doesn't understand why he's unpopular. His view is, I'm going to be unpopular for a bit because I'm trying to put the economy right and we have a black hole of 20 billion. And then promptly gives to the Ukraine 3 billion. I mean, he's got no sense of propriety at all. The man's a complete fool. But then if you look back, I know you want to talk about the Labour Party, but if you look back, you have problems with people like Boris Johnson, whose name was Alex when he was at school. Not Boris. And he had a problem with a father who used to beat his mother. So that scarred him. Now, he's able to cover all that but with his fake bonhomie and his, you know, his easygoing manner, so on and so forth. But that, of course, isn't the real Boris. We saw the real Boris when he stopped that peace agreement in the Ukraine at the cost of, as I say, 450,000 young Ukrainians dead. He sleeps tight at night. Moreover, he goes to the cenotaph and wears a poppy like he's, you know, let's all remember and peace is a good thing. These people are sociopaths in the main, sprinkled with psychopaths. They're all the same. And of course, that most of the backbenchers are journeymen. And if you look at the lineup from the Labour Party, I mean, you wouldn't pay them in shirt buttons, would you? Most of them. And some of them are sort of really out of sixth form state school debating societies. You know, they don't know anything. They've not been anywhere. The cabinet hasn't got a single member who's been in business at all. The previous lot were no better. But this is a sort of problem. No commercial experience. And of course, one thing that the Labour Party used to do historically and traditionally was to stick up for the working class in this country. Now, I've never had much time for the Labour Party's policies at all. But generally speaking, you couldn't really fault that their heart was in the right place. Their brain wasn't, but their heart was in the right place. They cared for the working class. The indigenous population working class, who have been now abandoned by Labour. And so this is the problem that we have, that these people are totally unrepresented. There isn't a single genuine policy which would support the indigenous population's working class. And so this is a dreadful situation that we find ourselves in when you have a very large slice of the majority of population who is totally unrepresented in what is supposed to be a representative democracy, which we both know doesn't work and hasn't worked for decades because you don't have a representative. The guy that goes and represents your constituency as a voter in this electorate in the United Kingdom is slightly less worse than anybody else you might have voted for when you went into the booth. And my great strap line when I was in politics, when I was cruising around, trying to drum up votes with my megaphone out of the rear of my Bentley, I used to say, just a minute, vote for me because I'm less disgusting and crooked than anybody else. I got elected on that ticket, by the way.
Congratulations. Well, with the Starmer's government, it's gone from lamentably bad to somehow even worse with Labour. So Starmer, he was parachuted in, doesn't have any experience, as he said, doesn't have any charisma. And about his upbringing, I think what that results in, where the child has to look after the parent, I think what that tends to result in is that the child's personality is underdeveloped because he hasn't been able to develop. He's not been doing his own things, having hobbies and what interests. He's just been looking after the parent. And with Starmer, it's famous now that he doesn't have a favourite book, doesn't have a favourite poem, doesn't listen to music, and also apparently doesn't dream. When he goes to sleep, he doesn't dream. It's amazing, actually, that he just seems to be like a showroom dummy, like an automaton. He just does things, but there's no actual personality. It's quite strange. But anyway, so he's created this government that, I mean, it's like a joke. Rachel Reeves is lied about her experience in the bank. Turns out that she... I mean, this is it's so incredible. I can't believe it's really happened. But she seems to have no experience whatsoever that would be relevant to being, where she now is. Would you like to talk about that?
Yes, I think one is always entitled to a little bit of exaggeration. I might perhaps, when I'm downwind of a few pints, perhaps imply that I played a slightly higher standard of rugby football than I did. But to actually, when you're going to be Chancellor, to suggest that you are... And funny, I don't know why she pretended that she was an economist. With the exception of myself, there are no economists in politics today who actually know shit from clay. The last thing she did was claim to be an economist, because you know, with the exception of myself, they're always wrong. She should have said, if she'd said something like I was a barmaid or a cab driver or a hooker, she'd have said, well, fair enough. We need a change, you know, at number 11. We need a change. But to pretend she's an economist when she actually couldn't take chalks at darts is absolutely ridiculous. So she's dug a hole for herself. And then we've got the Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, who has... Poor lass, her tongue is about three times bigger than it ought to be for a mouth, and she doesn't really understand even when she can actually string a sentence together. She doesn't seem to be able to answer any questions. I mean, she's painfully bad. She's painfully bad. Did you see her when she was saying, oh, I got all these heads of industry round a table and all this kind of thing? And they all say the same thing, but they're all wrong, and they're all exposed. But there doesn't seem to be any shame. I mean, if I drop a bollock, which I occasionally do, you know, I go blast, you know, shit, dropped a bit of a bollock there. I think I worry about it. But these people don't. They are shameless, which, of course, is the mark of the sociopath. It's the mark of the sociopath. So one wonders why they're in politics, what they want to do. The old school would want to get into politics in order to do some form of good. They might not have ended up like that. You know, they might have become cynical and old, but they started out that way. You can't claim that for any people who are in government today. And of course, they will all be swept out in 5 years' time because they are so bad. They're not. They've got to hand it to Blair. Blair was an evil, slippery sod, but by gum, he couldn't half perform. I mean, he didn't half make a good story. And sometimes I used to listen to Blair when he came to speak to, you know, the Parliament and sometimes small groups of English Parliament people, British Parliament, MEPs. And I would know he was lying. I would know he was lying because I spent years and years in the city, so I understand economics, I understand all these things, and I thought to myself, God, my goodness me, if I didn't know what I know, if I wasn't a professional in this field, I'd believe every word. He was absolutely unbelievably convincing, but these people aren't even convincing, are they? They're utterly hopeless, and so I don't quite know where we can go, and there doesn't seem to be, in my view, anybody waiting in the wings. But then Maggie took over the Conservative Party in about 1980, and she came from nowhere. She came from nowhere. And she did make mistakes. She made mistakes. I know she made mistakes. But broadly speaking, the economy went ahead and things were good. The 80s were good. You know, if you were an ordinary Brit with a family, a working man with a family, you did all right under Maggie. You know, and I had a friend of mine, he was a businessman. He said, if you couldn't score in Maggie's Britain, you were never going to score. And so that was his view. But this lot are absolutely hopeless. And of course, we've seen in Argentina, and I'm doing a lecture tour in South America in March. I'm going around, you know, Uruguay, Argentina. It's not for the first time. To see, I'm an Austrian school economist, to see what the new administration in Argentina is doing to actually cut the public sector, to cut regulation, to get the Argentinian economy moving forward for the first time in over 100 years, probably 120 years since it's been mucked up by ridiculous administrations there. So that'll be interesting. It's got to be firsthand. I don't want to just look at numbers. I want to get out. I want to talk to people. I want to go all over the place and find out what the word on the street is. And that's what economists, real economists, need to do. Because once you've read it in the accounts, once you've read it in the numbers, it's too late. It's already happened. You have to find out anticipatory. You have to be anticipatory when you're finding out how a country is going. And so we knew that Germany was going down the tubes. We knew France was going down the tubes. And it looks by the numbers that Argentina is back on the up. But I won't know until I get back. Maybe we'll have a little chat perhaps in April when I get back to see if I can add any value.
All right. Well, before we move on to what we might move on to, as you said, I want to ask another couple of questions about Labour, because a lot has happened. I mean, this is only, 5 months that they've been in power. Hardly even that. And a lot has happened. And one of them is the farmers, the protests there over the inheritance tax. We've already talked about that. But and then there's the pensions, the winter fuel allowance. But the big thing, and it would be remiss of me not to ask you this, and is the riots that happened in July and I think early August, and Starmer's reaction to those. Because to me, that was probably a defining moment for his premiership, an indication of the state of Britain today, what would you say about it? Obviously, it started because it was prompted by a brutal attack. I think 10 girls were attacked at a dance class by a young Welsh Rwandan English boy, Axel Rudikabanana, it seems to be, I think you're allowed to say that he is the suspect. And three of them were killed. Three of these wee girls were killed. So that was the basis for it. That was what prompted it. Then there were the riots. What would you say about all of that and Starmer's reaction?
Well, we now have a totally politicized police force, of course. I think had they been armed, he would have insisted they fix bayonets on their rifles and shot into the crowd or charged the crowd. I mean, there was no question about it. He is behaving in that manner because he is a sociopath, and this is one of the problems that we have. But of course, what we have to bear in mind, that the whole point, it's all packed in with our immigration policy. It's all part of the immigration policy. And the previous government was no better. And it comes now out from Noreen Doris, Dorries, I should say. She said that Sunak wanted immigration because he felt it would put a lid on wage inflation by bringing in people from abroad to work. And so stupid was Sunak, he thought these people were coming in to work. It beggars belief, and of course he's another WEF stooge. What everybody has to understand, and of course on your channel I'm preaching to the choir, this is all quite deliberate. Mass immigration is to degrade our nation state. That is the point of it. And it's the same with Germany, it's the same with France, it's the same with Italy, it's the same all over Western Europe. The Eastern Europeans aren't having it, the Poles and the Hungarians aren't having it. They put up the barbed wire and say, no, it's not for us. And of course, now we live in countries which are so degraded by this mass immigration in every way, but particularly the clash of cultures is the problem. And of course, we have a welfare state and there's not enough to go around. Now, I'm not, as an Austrian school economist, I'm not anti-immigration at all. I'm not anti-immigration. If you want to come into this country and you have something to offer, you know, if you're a nurse or a doctor or electrician or a plumber or something, I regard you as being welcome. You're welcome to come in. You're adding to society. And if you're a good fella and you keep your nose clean and you keep out of trouble and you want to apply for British citizenship after a couple of years, I think you're perfectly entitled to do so. So I'm not anti-immigration. What we can't have is a complete change of culture. We now have more people who are Muslim in the country than Welshmen. There are more Muslims than Welshmen.
I think it's specifically Pakistanis. I think there are more Pakistanis than Welsh, but it might be Muslims overall. I can't recall.
Well, as I say, and I have nothing against, I've got some friends who are Muslims. You know, I'm not anti-Muslim either, incidentally, not at all. But there's a limit to how many you can take, especially if they don't want to be not integrationist. And we know that some immigrants are integrationist. So the Sikhs, for example, are integrationist. The Ahmadiyya Muslims are integrationist. They keep their own religion, they do their own thing. But apart from that, they're British and they want to be British and they're proud to be British. And that's the way forward. A lot of people coming now are like that. They're coming here because they are going to get benefits. They're going to get medical. They're going to get put up in hotels, three meals a day, medical treatment, cash to spend. They're free to roam everywhere. And we now have a situation which I blogged about the other day. I have a friend of mine, a young lady, who works in Lloyd's of London. She's got a little house across the river in Bermondsey, which is semi-gentrified. And of course, there are masses of young men put into hostels in that part. These are young men in between 20 years old and 30 years old, bursting with testosterone and all the rest of it. She now has to get a cab. She used to walk across the Tower Bridge and walk home from Lloyd's of London, or get a bus part of the way. Her parents now, she's very young, she has to be subsidized by her parents to get a taxi cab back to her place. And of course, one might argue that this is going on all over the country because their attitude, newcomers from different cultural backgrounds have a different attitude to women. Goodness me, there's a different attitude to women between Yorkshire and London. Make no mistake. So we all have our different ways of treating women, and women have different ways of their association with men. But when you're bringing people from the Horn of Africa or the Middle East or the Indian subcontinent, who actually understand or believe in the concept of ownership of a woman. And before anybody gets their knickers in a twist, this was River Wars. Winston Churchill referred to this in his book, River Wars, in 1902. He said they're good soldiers, they're loyal members of the empire, but they have this, how can we integrate them into an empire when they have attitudes which are frankly from the Stone Age? And of course, who's gone very quiet now? Women's Lib, the Women's Libbers and the women's groups. When I suggested once, I think years ago on some program, I can't remember what it was, so women had trouble reversing into car parking spaces, you know, and men weren't only good at finding mustard in the pantry, very good, because we'd got different spatial skills and all the rest of it. My goodness me, they wanted to hang me. They wanted to hang me for suggesting what everybody knows. But now, well, they've gone quiet. Where are they all? All these harridans, these screechers, these shills who hated my guts and wanted to hang me. Rape in Bournemouth has gone up 800%. Bournemouth, 800%. But we're not allowed to talk about it. And when Rupert Lowe from the Freedom Party, what it's called, he says, can we have the figures? You must have the figures. No, we haven't got the figures. You can't have the figures. Why can't we have the figures? We all bloody well know why we can't have the figures, don't we? You don't need the bloody brains of an archbishop to know why they won't give us the numbers. So we're not being told the truth, because they knew if the truth was actually coming out, although where it would come out, they could tell Rupert Lowe, because nobody would publish it. The newspapers are owned by the state or state actors. And it's the same with the BBC, who will never tell the truth about anything, which is why it's going down the lavatory. So we need to know those figures if so people could make an assessment. But people are beginning to vote for their feet in the ballot box in Germany and France. And they have done in Italy, which has proved a bit of a damp squib. But people are fed up with this. People are very fed up with this. So they're changing their voting habits. Not here yet. But that there hasn't been a real party come forward yet who actually got their ducks in a row. That might happen. We don't know.
Well, that gets us to the issue of reform. reform were seen, and I suppose by some people still are seen, as a natural and decent replacement for the Conservative Party. It's Farage's project. I think it is the rebranded Brexit Party. As an entity, it was the same. It's the same entity as the Brexit Party, but it's now a multi-issue actual political party. And there was some optimism about it. But what would you say? This is Richard Tice, I think Rupert Lowe, and Nigel Farage as the sort of three most prominent members of it. But what would you say about reform?
Well, I advocated people voting reform on my channel before the election. And I voted reform myself because I felt it was the only game in town. It was that or don't vote. However, I see the same mistakes being made with reform as they made with UKIP. And it was a Charlie call, as we used to say in the army, to the Conservative Party, come and join us. Come and join us. And all you get, or we got from UKIP on that in those days, it was one of the reasons I resigned from UKIP, one of many. It's the same problem that we have now. Who's coming across? People have lost their seats. The flotsam and jetsam of the Conservative Party, the losers, the grade C-listers, all these people in search of a seat because it looks like the Reform Party are on the up. All they want to do is stay in politics. They're not conviction politics. And what is it actually saying to Labour voters? I will represent in Yorkshire and North Lincolnshire. Masses of my UKIP members and supporters and branch chairmen were old Labour up here. And God bless them. Sometimes I call them the sergeant's mess. They're the ones with common sense. You know, they're the common sense people. And now all the same mistakes. You don't want failed Conservative politicians. They should be told to bugger off. And we had tens of thousands of people marching in London 4 or 5 weeks ago, waving Union Jacks, who were Reform voters who would have delivered leaflets for reform. And what did Tice say? We don't want to be associated with that lot. What do they say when it came to Big Pharma? Look at their history of Big Pharma. Of what they said when it was compulsory, mandatory vaccinations, of which most of them were in favour. So have they changed their spots? I, at the moment, think that they are Tory light. They're Tory light. They want a bit less regulation, a bit less tax, and to tighten up a little bit on immigration, so on and so forth. So really, their natural home is in the Conservative Party, maybe on the more radical wing of the Conservative Party, but they're Conservatives to a man. Very, very few of them impress me. Lee Anderson impresses me, and Rupert Lowe impresses me. But I think everyone else there is a journeyman. They're all journeyman politicians. And I don't see much original thinking. And I don't see much I don't see much commitment to the biggest problem we have at the moment, which is without doubt the mass immigration problem. One of the party policies that they should be, they skirt around it, maybe they'll come out with it, you have to mobilize the Royal Navy and you have to tow illegal immigrants back. And you have to send people who landed here illegally by aeroplane back. That's what you have to do. And when people go, oh, well, there's an international law and there's the European Court of Human Rights and all this, you say, just a minute. No, I'm sorry. We tow them back. And if we have to sink French ships to do that, we sink French ships. We've done it before and we need to do it again. And so they realize that we are talking tough and we're going to act tough. I'm not hearing that. I'm not hearing any of that.
Certainly. I think the strange thing about reform is, I forgot about Lee Anderson completely. I should have mentioned him. But the strange thing about reform is that at this moment, other countries, as you said, are adopting a harder line about certainly mass immigration and diversity, multiculturalism. In fact, as we're speaking, I don't know if you know about this, but within the last few hours, there's been a Christmas market attack in Magdeburg in Germany. Looks like 3 people at least are dead and 10 people are injured. This has just happened. It's amazing. Well, it's eerie for me because I spoke in Magdeburg a few years ago, 2018. So I very vaguely know the town. But that's just happened right now. I should mention that.
I hadn't heard. I too know Magdeburg. It was just inside the inner German border, of course, when I was serving out there. I got a trade from Berlin to Berlin to play rugby, interesting. And the train was boarded by the East German police with their guns and their Alsatian dogs and all the rest of it. And I might have possibly had a sherbet or two, but I put my finger into the nozzles of one of the guns that they were pointing at me. And it was a very funny experience because there was a very, very pretty girl in the carriage who was East German. We were going from Berlin back to the West to get it right. And I'd been talking to her and she had a bottle of vodka, which is why I was a bit pickled. And when the East German guard really got very cross indeed about this, she barked at him in German, which I don't have, modest French, but that's about it. She barked at him in German, and he virtually clicked his heels together and buggered off. I don't know who she was, but she was obviously an important young lady, well-connected. I would like to have got much better connected with her, I have to say, but I was a young man.
I can understand. Right, someone's just said it's actually 11 dead and 60 injured. Someone in my chat, I don't have that verified, but this is obviously another of these terrible Christmas market attacks, which seem to be a particular magnet for terrorism. But the point of, I mentioned that because it's relevant to what we're saying, that the migrant crisis in 2015 led to a whole new order of immigration into Europe and Britain, and it's turned out dreadfully. And so now there are these rising parties. The AfD in Germany is the one in Germany, but it's happening elsewhere as well. The politics are hardening against mass immigration, and so this is why it's strange to me that reform, this was a golden, I don't know, once in a lifetime opportunity. Labour are in a dreadful state. The Conservatives are even in an even worse state. This is the moment for Nigel Farage to launch something, a really effective new platform opposing mass immigration. And yet he seems to have completely failed to grasp that opportunity.
Well, I know I used to have drinks at my flat for Marine Le Pen, for example, the Princess Beatrix of the AfD and the Duke of Oldenburg. They used to come for drinks and so on. They're not extreme right. They're patriots. They're patriots, but they're not painted. These people, I know them personally over drinks, you know. I've lost touch now, of course, but I can assure you They're not extreme right at all. They're just patriots who wants to get their country back. Now, you know, we should be talking about, really, if you're here illegally, you must be deported. You must be deported. And if you are a criminal immigrant, whether you're legal or illegal, if you are convicted of crime, you must be deported. There's no ifs or buts. You must go, and there must be a plan. There must be a plan for doing that. And I would have a retired chief of staff, maybe a senior admiral, although the trouble is with senior officers, it's been politicized. The military now is politicized as well. I noticed that when I was in it. And that started back in the 1980s, believe it or not. So you have to have a strategy for this, and it has to be written down. And you have to tell people, this is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to do. No ifs and buts. I fear that the leadership of reform, and I could be wrong, and I most certainly hope I am wrong, are trimmers. It's a word that people don't use much these days, but they're trimmers. They don't really stand on the platform and say, we're going to do this. This is the only solution. It's always, we're on the one hand and on the other hand, but we're jolly well going to be jolly tough. And it reminds me a little bit of King Lear. You know, I shall do such great deeds, they shall be the terrors of the earth. I know not yet what they are. I'm getting a sniff of that a little bit from reform.
Yeah, there's a lot of bravado in Nigel Farage's sort of energy, but no specifics about this or that, and certainly not on this crucial.
It went wrong, Colin, when, if you remember, and this is the thing that I'm afraid that fringe parties don't understand. I made this point before. If you're going into Westminster, if you've got into an election like the European election, you can have your protest vote. You can have your protest vote if it's a by-election. You can have your protest vote if it's a local election. You can kick ass. But when it comes to a Westminster election, you have to put forward a political party with a plausible front bench. You need a shadow chancellor, shadow minister, shadow home office, with people who are articulate, who know what they're talking about, who are informed, and committed. Now, the way UKIP failed in 2015 because they didn't do that. They thought they could wing it. They didn't win a single seat. And the reason they didn't win a single seat was because they didn't have spokesmen. People were saying, just a minute, what's your health policy? Where's your health guy? You know, where's your home secretary? Where's your chancellor? And there were none. And we still have a situation, do we not, where reform is a company with shareholders of which Nigel is the 51st or and over 51%. I'm not suggesting that's wrong. I'm not suggesting anything at all about that. It may be good, it may not be bad, but that will not be viewed in Westminster elections as a serious political party. The people won't accept it. They will pick up massive votes in by-elections, massive votes in local government. But when push comes to shove, and it's a question between Starmer's administration and hopefully not too hopeless conservative thing, they'll say, well, what can I do? Where's your team? Reform at the moment don't look like a team. They've got some talented individuals, but it's not a team. And, of course, it's a grassroots party. It's a grassroots party like UKIP used to be, and they're already talking about how to make it un-grassroots. We're going to professionalize this. We're going to do this. How can you be so wrong? How can you read it so wrong? We want a grassroots party with people who are grassroots, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, the cab driver, the barman, to come into politics and represent these things with good advice, with people behind the scenes advising them and doing technicalities and making sure that they've got the right figures in front of them, all the rest of it. We're fed up with professional politicians. That's why we've got the disgusting government that we've got now. They're all professional politicians, journeymen, picking up their pretty reasonable salaries, their index-linked pensions, and their ministerial cars and bits and pieces. Away with them. Away with them all.
Oh, absolutely. I think Nigel Farage's... it speaks of his lack of seriousness, that he hasn't done what you're saying. So he does have a few... loud voices, Rupert Lowe, and Richard Tice, obviously, and Lee Anderson. But he hasn't assembled a team, a shadow cabinet, as it were. So nobody knows if we vote for reform, who will be in charge of what? We've got no idea. And I think this is something that Nigel Farage has been guilty of before, where he talks a good game and he's full of, as I say, bravado, but he's not actually serious. He's not a very serious man, it seems to me, because otherwise he would have done this. I'm not sure whether he actually wants to win or if he just wants to be a gadfly.
Not the first person who's made that remark over the years. It's a little bit more fun being a maverick, and I understand that because I am a maverick myself. It's a lot more fun. It's a bit like being a wing forward on the rugby field, a number seven. You can dodge around everywhere. You break up attacks. You can tackle people to your heart's content, but you don't actually construct anything at number seven. It's not like number 10, where you have to either distribute the ball or kick the ball or play a safe game for touch or so on and so forth. He's a born number seven. Who's a disruptor, fun of the fair, with actually no great responsibility for the strategy and tactics of the game in hand. That's how I see it. And I say, you're not the first person to say that. And I think you might have touched on something.
Yeah, I didn't understand that, the rugby references, but I'll take your word for it. I can see what you're saying. He's a disruptor, but he's not a builder as such. He's certainly not... He seems to more enjoy the fun of disrupting and being this annoying figure for the establishment. But I can see him joining the establishment. I could see him being co-opted and just like merging reform with the Conservatives or something. Obviously, we can speculate in all sorts of directions. I'm just saying it wouldn't surprise me. Then that gets us to... another issue, which is obviously important this year, and I realize that it's not your wheelhouse exactly, but I will ask you to give your views on it anyway, which is Trump. And he's obviously won the election in America, and we're now looking at a second presidency for him. I guess that'll be 25 to 29. He'll be in the White House. What are your thoughts about Donald Trump at this point?
It was a difficult one because he doesn't always do what he says he's going to do, and vice versa. He's got some good people. I like Kennedy's going to go after Big Pharma, I think, if he can, if he's not assassinated, because this killing of the general in Moscow was about Big Pharma, but that's a whole other story. Your watchers won't know that, but that's the fact of the matter. So Kennedy might blow that one open. He might get Fauci in prison, which is where Fauci ought to be, along with a whole lot of other people. So he's got a good guy there. I think if he sticks to his guns, Trump, and he winds up the totally unnecessary carnage in the Ukraine, which is a child of BlackRock money, the CIA. And of course, Kennedy was right, the first Kennedy, President Kennedy, who said if he could do one thing, he'd get rid of the CIA. The CIA is really the trouble, the biggest troublemaker in the world, and the industrial military complex. That is the problem. The neocons in Washington, that is the problem. Now, I think Trump is a good start chance that Trump will try and get out of the Ukraine entanglement and mess, an expensive mess. But he looks to me like he can't wait to leap into the Middle East mess. The best thing for the Americans can do, and I'm very Atlanticist, I'm very pro-America, I've got lots of American friends, and I've been to over 35 states in my career, both business and politics, so I know a bit about America. They really need to bring everybody home. They're no good at running an empire. We were good at running an empire. They're not any good because they don't understand how to run an empire. An empire is not putting military bases all over the world. And if you don't like the regime, destabilizing it and costing, you know, hundreds and hundreds or thousands of civilian casualties that go with it. So it would be a much safer place if everybody stayed in their own country, all right? If everybody stayed, the Americans stayed in America, Germans stayed in Germany, and so on and so forth. This would be good. But If he could bring that about, I think that would be good. But I'm not sure, and he hasn't said anything to impress me that he's going to do that, out of the Ukraine, which will free him up to actually put more into the Middle East. His financial policies, his economic policies, are broadly flawed. He's a spender. He's a spender. He's not going to cut. The only thing that can actually save the United States is to cut spending. That is a very difficult game with Medicare and all the rest of it and the industrial military complex. He needs to cut spending. We haven't heard a great deal from him about cutting spending. It's all about bringing back manufacturing to the United States, which was, of course, sort of subcontracted everywhere because it's so expensive in the West and the Anglosphere to actually employ people. And there's regulations, so on and so forth. It all went to China. That was quite deliberate by American companies. They all went to China because you could manufacture stuff. China's now putting manufacturing into Vietnam. And you've got the Indian subcontinent. So we've got all these very complicated things, which clearly Trump doesn't understand. He doesn't understand them. I think his heart's in the right place. And I think he's a patriot. But it isn't as simple as that. You can't suddenly bring people back. International economics is very, very complex and intertwined. If you're going to be protectionist, which is what he's talking about with tariffs and all the rest of it, he has to bring everybody home. He has to slash the military budget. He has to slash tax, slash regulation, bring everybody back. And America could actually be isolationist. The United States could actually be isolationist and get away with it. But that's not what he's offering. That's not what he's offering. He wants to go on with the empire and the industrial complex and involve himself in other stuff, not as much perhaps as the Democrats would have done. He's not talking the right story because I honestly believe he doesn't really understand international economics. But then he's not alone. There isn't a politician in the West who understands economics at all. They just don't get it, or currencies, or regulation. They don't understand it, which is why we're all in the hole that we are. We wouldn't be in this terrible hole if we understood economics. But we don't. Keynes in economics has taken over all our universities. Everybody's training Keynes in economics, or what they now call modern monetary theory. And the translation of modern monetary theory is that debt doesn't matter. There are no circumstances on the face of this planet where debt doesn't matter. Debt always matters. And if you think a country, it doesn't matter for a country, it matters for the individual or a business, but not the country it's in, then you're misunderstanding the whole concept of the fiscal place in the world of all economies. No different, which is why the Soviet Union collapsed. You can't do it. You've really got to knuckle down and do your homework and do what needs to be done. I'm not hearing that from Trump. I'm not hearing that.
Well, yeah, there is Elon Musk's supposed or apparent involvement with Trump. He wants to increase government efficiency. I don't know whether he's going to be allowed or given some sort of post or just allowed to advise or pontificate about it. But either way, he is certainly pushing for massive improvements in government efficiency in America. I think Trump is aware of it as a problem. But as you say, there are a lot of worrying signs. And one of them is his apparent enthusiasm for intervening in the Middle East, which just seems to be America's eternal folly. Because, of course, it just means endless disruption there, chaos there, and mass immigration into the West, into Europe especially. And Trump doesn't seem to be prepared to defy the vested powers that be on that matter. It's a damn shame. Is there anything you would like to say about Syria and Bashar al-Assad?
Well, I think one of the problems we have there, I'm certainly not in possession of all the facts. I don't understand what's gone on in the past, although I do know we've been fed disinformation almost consistently by the CIA, so we don't really know what was going on in Syria to start with. But I think we will have to just wait and see. So I don't think I can comment on the way Syria is at the moment, but it seems to me that it's part of the collapse now is being taken advantage of by the Zionist expansionism. what they want to do. You know, that if you look at the beginning of that, if you look at the H. A. Balfour's letter to Nathan Rothschild, as it were, I think it was dated 1919 or something, but the letter's on the, you can Google up the letter, to say that this is your little bit, this is your homeland, but you mustn't up, you know, you mustn't encroach on the Palestinians too much, and you mustn't do this, and you mustn't do that, and you mustn't disrupt. That was the Balfour letter. And of course, now it's about expansion, 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 and all sorts of things. And of course, if you look at the Zionist project, they believe that they are the chosen people there and everything should belong to them from the river to the sea. And they're quite upfront about that. And of course, the Israelis run American foreign policy, which is annoys some of my American friends who aren't Zionists. But Congress is and the Senate is totally Zionist. So you have this small country with a very big mate. So you have a rogue small country with a very powerful ally. And that is very dangerous, as we've seen. But of course, permanent disruption and war is in the interest very often of the United States. It means that they can put their gas pipelines where they want to. They can put their petrol pipelines through Qatar, and that's a Syria. It was all about stopping the pipeline from Russia. It's all about oil. It's always about money. As a geopolitical economist, I can tell you one thing for sure, and your listeners and your viewers for sure. It's always about money. There are no exceptions. It's about money. And you will find that all the trouble in the world is about money. If you go back, people might bang the drum, they talk a good story, brotherhood and apple pie. It's about money.
All right. Well, on that matter, then I'll bring it back to Europe and our economy and our way of life. Do you think that climate change is going to fall away? As you know, that whole project, that whole state of mind that the WEF and the WHO and the UN were trying to promulgate a few years ago. Climate change seemed like the natural extension, the next iteration of that after COVID. Do you think that's going to fall away now, or do you think they're going to go full steam ahead with that? You know, all of the carbon credits, the electric cars and all of that nonsense.
Well, of course, what we do know is that climate change is about, the whole concept of climate change is about a global political strategy. I have a website. I think it's probably one of the most comprehensive websites on climate change now on my website, which drills down in some depth on this particular subject. The science is fake. The science is totally bogus. It's a stick with which to beat the electorate. You have to do what we say to save the planet. You have to do this, that, and it's not, we want to be nasty. We don't want to stop free speech. We don't want to do all these things, but the planet is going to die. And now it's this kind of bullshit. And of course it comes out with the BBC promulgated all the time. They've sacked anybody who challenged it. Nobody's allowed on the BBC or state broadcasting who challenges it. Nobody's allowed to challenge it. Although there are thousands and thousands of very prestigious scientists all over the world who say that it's a flawed theory. The carbon dioxide, it's a whole flawed theory. And you can only tell when it's being peddled by celebrities, actors, who always talk about carbon. Let me just say something about that. Carbon is soot. You know, when you're digging out your coal fire in your drawing room, what's left there, that black stuff, is soot. That's carbon. Carbon dioxide is a gas in the atmosphere, which is about 0.004 of the atmosphere. Carbon monoxide, if it escapes from your heater in your shed, your potting shed, will kill you. So we've got lots and lots of people talking about it. They don't know the difference between carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide. They certainly don't know how it works or what the implications of it are, but they bang the drum. They're pathetically, embarrassingly ignorant. Now, this is a problem, but it's a stick with which to beat the electorate. Now, here's the interesting thing with Trump coming on. There's something good about Trump coming in on this particular subject. He's actually said what I just said. It's bullshit. The whole thing's been bullshit from start to finish. We've been waiting for the planet to boil now for 35 years. And King Charles III, he just said the other day, he said, I've been banging on this about 30 years, you know, the climate. Yes, Your Majesty, 30 years. When's it going to start? When's it going to happen?
Yeah.
It's got nothing to do, you know, we're waiting.
The ice caps have got bigger in that time.
I've got a neighbour who planted, she bought into it 35 years ago. I've been living in my small holding for 40 years. She planted all sorts of exotic trees. They're all dead because it didn't happen. We thought Bridlington and Scarborough were going to be the new Riviera. No, sorry, not happening. How much longer are they going to peddle this totally flawed and ludicrous theory that Trump set up is absolute nonsense and we're going to drill for oil, we're going to do this and we're going to do the rat. So that's an upside. And you can't have the United States and the BRICS countries, which incidentally don't take any notice at all. They pay lip service, the BRICS. You're going to end up with only Western Europe taking any notice of this nonsense at all, which is why Germany is going down the tubes, which is why Britain has the highest cost of electricity in the world. In the world. How can you preserve manufacturing in your country if you have the highest cost of energy in the world? And incidentally, something else that you may or may not know, your viewers may or may not know, we are the eighth biggest manufacturing country in the world. As Michael Caine would say, not a lot of people know that. We're very, and it's mainly middle-sized businesses, small and medium-sized businesses, massive, 75% of our economy, incidentally. But they'll all die if they can't get reliable and cheap electricity, which, of course, the government knows, or the World Economic Forum knows, which is why they want to get rid of it, because they can get rid of small businesses. They don't like small businesses. They don't like self-employed people. They don't like any of this. They can't control it. They don't like small farmers. Put them out of business. I mean, it all comes from the Joseph Stalin playbook. It's all from Stalin. It's easy peasy to look at it. But of course, we don't have a free press. We don't have a free press. And so consequently, 80% of the population go with the flow in this country. And I think it's true of most countries. 80% of the population go with the flow. And so consequently, the man in the pub, I mean, I'm a graduate of the Royal College of Defence Studies on geomilitary matters, right? And so on and so forth. Now, I go to the local pub. The man who's read this morning's Daily Express thinks he's my equal. He does. He thinks he's my equal because he read this morning's Daily Express. And he accounts for 80% of the population. How can you ever get out of the shit that we're in when you have a faintly moronic electorate? And this is the sort of problem that we get. Do you know what a Cambridge graduate said to me, an erstwhile mate of mine? He said to me, and when we were arguing about something, I think it was Ukraine, I can't remember. Do you know what he said to me? He said, oh, Godfrey, you're wrong. This has been fact-checked by the BBC. He was a Cambridge graduate. Fact-checked by the BBC. I mean, what can you do? And he was a Cambridge graduate. What can you do? He's supposed to be in the top 2% of the brain power.
Oh, that's... That burns. That's a terrible statement.
I know.
I guess a lot of people still have... Well, I mean, it's... Yeah, they do. A lot of people do still have untrammeled faith in the BBC, in the powers that be. I don't know how. I don't know how they manage it, but they still seem to feel that that organization in particular is not lying to them and doesn't despise them. But I guess the other thing is, though, it's part of the self-image of being educated. Well, I don't fall for conspiracy theories and crazy claptrap. I go with the experts. I trust the experts because I'm intelligent and educated enough to know the experts are right. And it's that kind of vanity. I think it's all self-reinforcing with these people. If you're an educated person, well, then you don't believe conspiracy theories. You don't believe disinformation. You don't believe whatever you read on Twitter that day. You're more careful. You wait for the BBC to tell you what's true.
My favorite quotation from Lord Salisbury, round about 1890. He said, his quotation is, "Never trust an expert, they are nearly always wrong." That's 150 odd, nearly 150 years ago, Lord Salisbury. And he's got lots of belting questions like that. He's a fascinating man. Counterintuitively, Lord Salisbury was a great libertarian. Another great one, it was when he was being pressed by the Temperance Society to try and stop people drinking. His response was, it's a free-born Englishman's right to get as drunk as he likes. It's nobody's business but his own. He's got a whole shaft of them. And funnily enough, I was asked to give a lecture on Lord Salisbury to the Conservative Association at Cambridge University, and I was deplatformed. Lord Salisbury, the administration of Lord Salisbury in the 1890s, is far too hotter stuff to handle for the average modern Cambridge graduate.
Well, I can believe that. Given what I hear about Cambridge and the student life there, I mean, it's pretty doctrinaire at this point. Same with Oxford, of course. There's no competition.
You expect it from Oxford. You expect Oxford to be like that, don't you? Because it's where the numpties come from. The whole of the Conservative front bench are Oxford, aren't they? They all were. They're all Oxford. And I'm not just convinced of this. In order to get into Oxford as an undergraduate, you have to prove you've had a lobotomy. I'm absolutely bloody convinced of it.
Well, yeah. I think David Cameron went to Oxford, and his cabinet, I'm pretty sure they were very Oxford.
Almost to a man. Or woman.
Well, so we've got this educated class in Britain who are still very wedded to the establishment because their own social status is as part of that establishment. So nobody wants to admit. It's like the emperor has no clothes on, basically, that the establishment is corrupt and that the BBC lies. Lies more through omission, I think, than
actual
distortion.
Yes.
I was saying to someone recently on Millennial that I remember when the Dutch tractor protests started, the BBC simply didn't mention it. There was no... I did a Google search of the BBC website, and it had been going on for several months, and I think 4 months, if I recall correctly, and there was simply no mention of it. And then it became an even bigger story, and then finally... the BBC mentioned it, but it was like, as I say, it's lying by omission. The public just don't know, just like they didn't know about Hunter Biden's laptop and a whole load of other things. The BBC simply didn't mention it and thereby effectively lied and severely misled the public. And it's the same with the tractors, same with the Canadian trucker convoy protest. Same with everything about climate change. You said that the BBC fire celebrities who don't toe the line, and I immediately thought of two examples of that. The David Bellamy.
David Bellamy, certainly, yeah.
And also, I think, Patrick Moore. I don't know if they fired him exactly, but he definitely spoke out about climate change and became persona non grata thereafter. I mean, that has been going on for a long time. And so,
oh, yeah. I'm old now. I can never remember names, but I could shoot you another two or three. Jack DiMaggio on Brexit or joining the common market all those years ago. John Ball or whatever his name was, another resident scientist. They replaced him. They replaced him with an activist, a climate activist. So they replaced a scientist with an activist. And who would give the information like it was all sort of top scientific sort of chart. But then the whole thing, your political guru at the BBC is Laura Cheeseburger. Now, Laura Cheeseburger is on something like £350,000 a year. It's a state institution, the BBC. Look, Colin, if you were on 350 grand, you're out with a family to bring up. You'd shut your gob, wouldn't you? You wouldn't, and neither would I. But most people.
I don't know. But I certainly a lot of people would, because it's like they've just got too much to lose. And I guess that is a classic technique. You get people on board by making sure that they've got too much to lose, so they're not going to stray. But of course, some people still do. David Bellamy was one. And so... well, you just cut them off. You just make sure that the public won't hear them. It's Yeah, the BBC at this point just seems to be a machine for continuing that system of homogeneity. I wouldn't trust a damn thing I heard on the BBC. And I don't even say that with any glee or pleasure. I don't like it. Yeah. I'd rather that it was trustworthy. But I look at the BBC today and I just see an enemy organization, for want of a less dramatic phrase. There has been one super chat. I can't pronounce that name, but it says, it's so refreshing to listen to an older gentleman who is not a Zionist. Merry Christmas and a prosperous new year to you both. Well, thank you very much. And then somebody else said, hey, Woz, I'm loving Millennial again. Here are a few dollars for Yule. Stay strong. Well, thank you very much, Joe. Yeah, that's excellent. Is there anything else that you think we should talk about in terms of 2024 before we wrap up?
Can't think of a thing off the top of my head, but I think we're now at the stage at this time that we need to be starting looking forward. And there is something, let me leave this with perhaps your viewers. We're not, one of the small things, people say, oh, it's all really talk a good story, but what can we do? What can we do? What can we do? I tell you what I can do, everybody watching this, if you haven't already done it, and I suspect you have, don't pay the buggers at the BBC. Don't pay the buggers. Cancel your banker's order. Don't send them a check. Let them come and knock on your door and then bugger them off. It's very complicated to persuade you. All they get is little old ladies and single mums. They don't nick anybody else because they're too stupid. So, yeah, don't pay them. If nobody paid the BBC would disappear. But we go on paying. I've got friends of mine. I've got a friend of mine who's got a flat. He doesn't live in it. It's empty, and it's in a gated community thing, 150 miles away from where he now lives. He's paying, for the last 2 years, he's paid his BBC license religiously for 2 years. And he's a good mate, and he's a great mate, and he's otherwise a very intelligent bloke. And you want to knock him on the head and say, what is your problem? Just stop paying. Stop paying, everybody. Make that your New Year's resolution. Don't pay the buggers at the BBC.
Indeed. Well, the good news is that I read yesterday or recently that in the last year, 500,000 people have stopped paying their license fee. So that's huge. I mean, I don't know how the BBC is going to continue. Certainly, I mean, it's really in a dire state. And it has been for several years already. Even before that, it was really struggling to maintain the budgets on its dramas and so on, because they're just running out of money all over the place. But that's great. That's wonderful news, because the BBC, it either needs to downsize drastically and become a much more modest operation in every way. Or it needs to be abolished, I would say.
It's got to go.
Yeah,
it's got to go. It's an anachronism. It's an anachronism. There are something like 17 or 18 free view channels that you can tap into. Free view, which is subsidized by the commercial advertising, so on and so forth. The BBC was a wonderful idea in 1926. The National Health was a wonderful idea in 1947. Do you drive a 1947 car? If you've got a 1947 phone, it's bullshit. It's gone. It's over. It's ended. It's gone away. We have to move on. And the NHS has to move on. The BBC, they're all HR directors. They're all HR people. In the NHS, hardly anybody treats patients. They've got 600,000 people in the NHS who don't aren't doctors, nurses, radiographers, or surgeons. What do they all do? What do they do? 600,000. You need a few staff here and a few staff there. If you go back to the NHS and if you went to the old Doctor, those wonderful Doctor films, you know, with Dirk Bogarde and James Robertson Justice, the whole hospital was administrated by the bursar, the chief surgeon and the matron, and they met once a month. You know, it worked.
Yeah.
Now you've got people rushing about. We've got people who are interested in climate change. You've got climate change people. You've got diversity people.
Where are
the bloody nurses? Where are the bloody nurses?
Well, this is the thing. It's one of those areas that's just a, a, a free-for-all. Like, bureaucrats can get in there and then just proliferate and eat up the entire budget and suffocate it. So eventually there's nothing going on but bureaucracy.
Do you remember the Yes Minister? He visits a hospital and he goes, and he said, there aren't any patients. No, there aren't any patients. He says, well worth your views. You can Google it up. You can find it. It's a great sketch. He's visiting this hospital, and the hospital manager says, oh, we're not ready for patients. We won't be ready for patients for years. And then he goes on to show them the surgery, the beds, everything. It's wonderful. It's pristine. Oh, but no, we can't deal with patients yet. And when was Yes Minister? It was in the early 1980s, wasn't it?
Yeah, early and mid-80s, yeah.
Nothing's changed. It's got worse. Nothing's changed. It's got worse.
Incredible. It's that thing about the, I've forgotten what the origin of this was, but there was a story about Russia in the Soviet Union where the organization that was like a company, it was supposed to do this thing, but eventually they had, like, they were supposed to make buttons or something, manufacture buttons, and eventually the bureaucracy was so extensive that they hadn't produced any buttons. It was just about meeting targets for the bureaucracy, and the actual point of the organization had been completely forgotten. I think that's typical, as I say, where there's a something to do with the state, where it's a state monolith. I think there has to be someone ensuring that the bureaucracy doesn't grow and proliferate, because otherwise it simply will. Okay, Essex Nomad said, Merry Christmas, Colin and Godfrey. Does Godfrey envisage a UK currency or debt crisis in the near future, or will we just limp along for a few more years? A debt crisis?
Yes, we have a debt crisis today. I go into it in some, if I may plug my website with your permission. If you look at my website, godfreybloom.uk/gold/, it goes into big, it's the most comprehensive page on this subject in the country at the moment. And it has guest experts coming in and so on. This is the field I was in, I know something about. It's worth having a look, and it shows you the numbers, the graphics involved in all these things. Yes, there'll be a massive debt crisis. There's going to be a currency. Fiat currency crisis, and it's not just this country, it's going to be Western Europe and it's North America. And it's also full of all sorts of things that generally we don't talk very much about, but it's like shadow banking, it's all sorts of other things. So the debt, we talk about the debt in the United States being $32 trillion, it's very, very significantly higher than that if you look at the implications of shadow banking. And it's the same in Western Europe. You can only protect your family by having what is known as hard currency, real currency, or real money. And that is it's gold coin. And if you can accumulate even small amounts of gold coin, it will protect you to a certain extent. And if things get very much worse, you might find that a store of grub is a good idea as well. I've got a room in our place, which is heavily stacked with tin stuff, you know, tin pies, tin this, tin that, rice puddings, all the rest of it. And if I'm wrong, and we don't end up in the poo poo, I'll be glad. I don't want it to happen, but my first responsibility and yours watching this channel is to you and your family, nobody else. Nobody else can help you when the shit hits the fan. Make sure that you look after you and yours. And if you visit that website, you'll find lots of ways of finding out how to do it.
Excellent. And I might recommend people watch a 1979 children's TV drama called Noah's Castle, which was about a scenario like this, where there's a debt crisis, a food shortage, and people end up scavenging and so on, and the one family, one man, has prepared for it by stocking up. Very interesting, very good. You can get it on YouTube. Noah's Castle, 1979. That was back
I'll look at that.
TV drama was good. Even kids' drama was good.
Oh, thank you for that.
Yeah. All right. And maybe next time says paying my Millennial X license fee. Thank you very much. Rogue Trader says, cheers, great stream, Godders. Thank you. And the Sasquatch says, just want to say thank you, Woz, Godfrey, and to all your guests and everyone in the chat. Christmas is a crappy time of year for me, and this lifts my spirits every year and helps me get through it. I wish you all the best. Well, thank you very much, Sasquatch. That is the idea for people who aren't in a position to have a traditional Christmas with family and all that, or even for people who are. I want people to have something else that they can additionally draw comfort from at this time of year, because a lot of people do get hit hard by Christmas for one reason or another. It should be a time of warmth and celebration and so on, but for some reason, for some people, I think that the pressure of that gets to them. So yes, it's nice to give some, it's nice to have something else as well. Okay then, I think those are all the super chats. So yeah, I think we can leave it at that. I think we've covered a huge range of topics, Godfrey. So thank you very much for that. Okay. Yes, I think that's everything. All right. So yeah, I think this is your fourth time on Millennial, and I think it's nice. It's become a sort of tradition, and I hope we continue it in the future.
Thank you for inviting me, and a very happy Christmas to everybody watching.
All right. I'll be back in about half an hour with Dan Tubb. But in the meantime, Godfrey, thank you for appearing on Millennial. And I will see you all later on.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The festival goes on, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the lights on.